What's going on, movie fans? I'm John.
And I'm Rossi, and this is Movie Lovers Unite, the podcast where your favorite films come to life.
Every week, we deep dive into the movies you love, from cult classics and guilty pleasures to the latest in theaters and streaming.
We're talking reviews, reactions, heated debates, top five lists, and interviews with filmmakers, actors, and fellow fans.
Whether you're a casual viewer or a hardcore cinephile,
we've got something for you, with laughs, hot takes, and plenty of popcorn-worthy moments.
New episodes drop every week on YouTube, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and wherever you get your fix.
So grab your snacks, press play, and join the conversation, because the movie talk is just getting started.
Welcome to Zombie Strange, the podcast where we watch all of the zombie movies in order. This episode, the year is 1963. We return to Mexico with La Cabeza Viviente, The Living Head.
No, I've seen people act like that in pictures. What do they call them, zombies or something?
Zombie.
What's a zombie?
Just what is a zombie?
Well, a zombie, there's, Mr. Bill, there's...
The living dead.
They are the living dead.
Get into zombies.
It's an army of zombies. No armies could stand.
Because a zombie has no will of his own.
What is wrong? What is wrong?
Welcome to Zombie Strains. I'm John.
I'm Andy.
I'm Brad.
It occurred to me just as I was about to say I'm John that if I were any good at this, I would have learned how to say hello and welcome to Zombie Strange in Spanish.
Oh, man.
Because that would have been appropriate. Next time we do a film from Mexico, which I assume we're going to do another one.
More are coming.
All right. Forget I said that, everybody. I want it to be a surprise.
So. We also need to brush up on your Italian.
Yes. We got Italy coming up. We've got a lot of Spanish language movies. I'm curious about what other countries we've got going on here. But we are in Mexico this time, and our movie is La Cabeza Viviente. We're translating that as The Living Head. I want to talk about this movie in depth, but before we do that, anybody reading or watching anything interesting related to this podcast?
So I've been watching something that has started to feel related to this podcast, although maybe it's just because I think about zombies now all the time.
Yeah.
So I've been rewatching the short-lived TV show, The Terminator Sarah Connor Chronicles. Did you guys see that one?
No. I did not.
It has Lena Headey as the Sarah Connor and Summer Glau as like a friendly Terminator sent back to protect them.
Okay.
And I mean, it was only around for like a season and a half, but I keep thinking about films like
The Creature with the Atomic Brain. Yeah.
The Creature with the Atomic Brain. And I remember when we talked about those movies, one of us commented that the zombies in those movies, they work like Terminators rather than zombies. And
yes.
So watching this Terminator show, it really sometimes feels like a weird, distant relative of a type of zombie movie that went out of style, but like shifted genre into like sci-fi robots. Because just like a lot of our early zombies, they're strong, they're slow, and they mindlessly follow orders, and they're just utterly immune to any kind of weapons the humans have. And that's kind of how a Terminator operates, right?
Yeah, what's interesting about that is that one of my observations very early on in this podcast was that zombies don't act like feral animals. They don't act like anything we recognize, because all animals will have some sense of self-preservation, whereas Terminators and our traditional zombies do not.
Yes.
You know what I mean? So that's interesting. That's a great observation, Andy, that they're somewhat related.
Yeah. Well, at some point, zombies will become less physically menacing. I think we're already moving in that direction, you know, because by the time of Night of the Living Dead, they don't seem to be stronger than like a regular, they were in life, right?
Yeah. At some point, we start mowing them down.
Right. But early zombies, I think, you know, I think the fear you were supposed to feel is similar to the fear you feel when you see a Terminator, you know, shrugging off gunfire and just charging at the heroes, completely unstoppable. And I mean, I think the biggest difference is that the early zombies moved at a pace of like 10 feet per minute, whereas Terminators, you know, can catch up, can run after you.
So. Yeah,
Yeah. All right. There's my little Terminator aside. Thanks for indulging me.
Yeah. I think you could add on to that. Terminators operate based on programming. They don't have their own willpower.
Yes.
So it's like a basic level of instinct, which is the same as a zombie.
Yes. But like some of those early zombies, you wonder if there's a piece of humanity left in them, right? And usually there's not, but some of the Terminators do seem to have a shard of humanity left in them. And that is not unlike the sort of mental gymnastics that a lot of zombie movie protagonists have to do when their loved one comes after them, right? Are they truly just a monster? Is there any way I could appeal to the humanity in this thing? So,
yeah, which happens in our movie today. Spoiler.
Yes.
There's a little bit of that. I will say, in my case, I'm gonna cheat and do what you did and say, Andy, I'm almost done with Alien Earth so we can be friends again.
Oh, good.
And
good.
I only bring that in because couldn't we argue that synthetics are much like zombies? No, we can't. They have willpower and other things, but they are unstoppable. So,
yes.
Yeah. It's great, by the way.
Yeah.
Like, I wasn't sure. And then I just watched the seventh episode. And I'm like, as soon as we're done recording here, I've got to watch the finale. So.
Yes. It took me a few episodes to really buy into what it was doing. But
yes.
Once it got me pretty good, I'd say. So
yeah, I think so, too. I do want to say something about this movie we watched. The setting or the background to this movie is sort of Aztec mythology and its place in the history of Mexico. So this isn't a trigger warning exactly as much as I want to say. This probably has as much with a true Aztec life as, our voodoo movies have to do with actual voodoo or The Exorcist has to do with actual Catholicism, right? I'm sure it's just trumped up. But there is a great, if you want to read a great history book about the Aztecs, there's one called The Fifth Son, written from the perspective of the Aztecs, and it's phenomenal. When I saw we were doing this, I had read that book like 6 months ago, and I'll just mention it here. It's very good.
Really? Okay.
Yeah.
That sounds really good. Then that's nonfiction, right?
It is nonfiction. It's written from the perspective of the Aztecs actually did record their history post Cortez, and there were still enough of them alive when they started the project to remember a little bit of what it was like before. So it's actually from Aztec writings as a sort. Part of it is Aztec writings as a source.
Wow.
I think makes it kind of unique. So I recommend it.
I don't know the answer to this, but I would really like to know more about that relationship of Mexican filmmakers and storytellers to these cultures, these Mesoamerican cultures that like lived in the same space as them. You know, does that lend itself to more faithfulness than American filmmakers used when they went out to Haiti to find a quote exotic religion and squeeze it into their zombie stories? Or are Mexican filmmakers just being as ridiculous with these histories as anyone else? I don't know. I would like to know. So listeners, if you know more about that, send me a book or something like that. Send me a link to a book or something.
I would, if anybody knows, because I think what's interesting is that the indigenous people in Mexico, are a little more integrated and part of Mexican society than Native Americans are here. But that's not always, it's not like it's a better situation. It's just different. And I don't really understand it. So,
okay.
All right. Having said all of that, Brad.
Bring us back down to earth.
Well, yeah, bring us back down to the actual movie we watched.
La Cabeza Viviente. In America, The Living Head was released on March 3rd, 1963. The big movies from 1963 were Cleopatra, How the West Was Won, Bye Bye Birdie, The Great Escape, Flubber, and in the horror world, The Birds. At the horror box office, there were a lot of Corman films, The Haunted Palace, The Raven, and The Terror. And there are two other classics, The Haunting and Blood Feast, were also released in 1963.
How gross is Blood Feast? I recall it being really gross, but that was a long time ago.
Your question is, does it live up to the title is what you're asking?
Correct, correct.
And based on your experience with these last, three dozen zombie films, what does your gut tell you?
Probably not, but I'm wondering. I'm curious.
If you watch it, John, you have to watch Missile Monsters and let us and answer that long unanswered question of whether it lives up to its title.
No, I'm just curious if when is it going to get nasty? Because there's a little nastiness in this, but not yet. But soon it's going to, like, 70s movies can be disgusting. So we'll have to see.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, Chano Ureta directed the film. He also directed the revived Monster, which was our first Mexican film released back in 1953. We did an episode on it a few months ago.
We loved it.
The Living Head is the 98th film of Ureta's career. He was very prolific, directing 116 films in a career that began in 1928 and lasted until 1974.
Man,
crazy.
The Living Head was produced by the Mexican production company Cinemita Grafica. Cinemita Grafica was a big producer of films during the golden age of Mexican horror. Two of their big films were El Vampiro, or in English, The Vampire, and The Brainiac. The Brainiac was made just before La Cabeza Viviente with much of the same cast and crew. Cinemata Grafica was owned by Abel Salazar. Salazar was also an actor and is in the cast of The Living Head. He plays the inspector, the police inspector. Salazar has 75 acting credits, 34 producing credits, and 14 directing credits. Ana Luisa Pelufo plays Marta. She has over 200 acting credits. Her first was in 1948, and her last was the 2014 TV series El Mariachi.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's a career.
Well, it's nice to have a lead actress who didn't die in a strange way shortly after the film was made. So
it's a low bar to set.
But.
Mauricio Garces plays Roberto, Marta's love interest. In the late 60s, Garces appeared in several films as a dashing playboy, often named Mauricio, the first being Don Juan 67. Garces has that kind of Cary Grant kind of charm.
Yes.
German Robles plays Professor Muller. Robles is famous for playing the vampire in El Vampiro 1957 and the follow-up The Vampire's Coffin from 1958. He was also a voice actor in many Spanish dubs of American movies. He voiced Blofeld in Under Majesty's Secret Service.
Huh.
He was Kit in the Latin American broadcast of Knight Rider. And amazing. He was General Grievous in Revenge of the Sith.
Oh, that's amazing.
That's a career.
Well, he probably had a really scratchy General Grievous voice by that point because he smokes constantly.
John, always hyper-focused on...
I'm hyper-focused on smoking.
The cigarette smoking of the era.
Do you know how hard it is not to correct your pronunciation of General Grievous's name? It's not Grievous.
Apparently not that hard because you just did
it. Yeah, I got it. Failed my saving throw. All right, go ahead. Carry on.
The Living Head features, well, a living head. More specifically, a decapitated head on a table which talks, which got me wondering what other films have heads on tables? I mean, the first that comes to mind for most of us horror fans is Reanimator from 1985.
Yeah.
But there are others.
The Brain That Wouldn't Die, right?
From 1962.
Well, we watched a fantastic head on a table movie in this podcast.
We did. The Frozen Dead from 1966. Yeah. The first example I could find was a German film called The Head from 1959 about a mad scientist who creates a serum to extend life but dies suddenly from a heart attack. So his assistant uses the serum to keep the doctor's head alive and keep the work alive.
That sounds like Reanimator, but German.
And you mentioned The Brain That Wouldn't Die, and that's also about a woman who's decapitated in a car crash, and her doctor boyfriend keeps her head alive on his table. In 1963, The Mad Men of Mandoras, also known as They Saved Hitler's Brain, which features Hitler's living head in a jar.
Can we watch that?
That's the film that I had on our list, but I took off because it's a head in a jar, but I couldn't find any examples of zombies in it.
All right, fair enough.
Frozen Dead from 1966 about Nazis and they're experimenting on a woman whose head is on a table.
Yeah, I would feel worse about you striking that film if I didn't have this feeling we have a lot of zombie Hitlers in our future.
I think so. And let me be clear, we're not like pro-Nazi or pro-Hitler.
We like seeing
Hitler dead with his head on a table because it's probably really unpleasant. I just wanted to clarify that for everybody.
Return to Oz from 1985 features a gallery with over a dozen talking heads on pedestals.
Did you guys watch that movie?
So no.
Like, that was my movie. That was my nightmare fuel movie or miniseries, whatever it is, when I was a kid. And it was those heads. I have not watched it in decades, but go to YouTube and tell me if that is as creepy as my childhood memory says it was. Because that was some good decapitated head stuff.
You didn't share the experience with your children?
I have not. Maybe it's time. Just call my oldest is at college, but I'll summon them back home for this important family.
Yeah, good plan.
Frankenhooker from 1990 is again about a med student trying to save his fiance. She's been decapitated and he tries to make a new body for her from sex workers.
Yeah, I know that one. Moving on.
Yeah, you is that your way of saying you own that one, John?
Don't own it. Just have seen it.
This is a no judgment zone.
Oh, a little judgment there on
judgment.
I am totally going to judge you, but go ahead. Carry on, Brad.
That's right. 1993, Mars Attacks features Pierce Brosnan and Sarah Jessica Parker decapitated and on tables and flying on discs and all sorts of positions.
I thought that, guys, I'm sorry, I keep butting in on Brad here. I'm the only person I know who enjoyed that movie. Did you guys like that movie?
I did not the first time I saw it in the theater, but it did grow on me.
Okay. I thought it was hilarious. I've never rewatched it because it probably wasn't hilarious at all, and I don't want to know. So,
well, I think you need to do Return to Oz and Mars Attacks again.
Clearly, double I have feature. A lot of childhood stuff I need to confront here. So, all right, that'll be a future episode.
In 2014, in the film The Voices, Ryan Reynolds is a killer, and several of his decapitated victims talk to him while on tables, counters, or shelves in the fridge.
Ooh.
I missed that one.
I did too. When that popped up, I was surprised. Now, the Alien movies have quite a few android heads on tables, but those are androids. So yeah, I don't quite count them.
Synthetics don't count. That sounded really racist, but they don't.
Well, it's different. Being sustained alive, if you're an android, it's not the same as a human head.
That's right.
Evil Dead 2 also has Ash's girlfriend, Linda, but she's a demon, so I don't think that quite counts. And I'm sure I'm missing quite a few, and I'm sure people can email me and we can add to the list, but...
Yeah, I thought of one that you missed, which is The Adventures of Baron Munchausen features Robin Williams' character with a head that could detach from his body and fly around.
Whoa, okay.
I was kind of looking for ones where the heads were on tables and trays and sort of in the science.
That's fair.
I feel like there must have been like a Freddy movie or something where,
right? How there, is there
where
not?
He's a yeah. head or something like that. I don't know. I didn't really watch those slasher movies. It just feels like something that would be at home there.
As a side note, Robert Englund just got a star on the Hollywood Walk of Fame.
I saw that. There you go.
That is what I have, gentlemen.
All right. Well, that's an incredible amount of research for a Spanish language film that doesn't have a good American translation or dub for it. So kudos to Brad for that one.
Can we talk for a minute? I am surprised and flustered sometimes at how hard it is to find like descriptions or discussions of movies like this.
Yeah.
Like there's a real dearth of information online. You would think that this would be the sort of thing that some niche community has extensively documented, but really you have like a one word summary of it on Wikipedia and then that's about it.
That's surprising to me.
Even cast listings like were kind of weird. Like, did you notice that one of the guys in multiple places on the internet, one of the policemen is credited as simply policeman who is killed by Chew, by the mummy.
Yeah.
And like, I mean, surely that's not how he was credited in the movie. I don't know. Just, I feel like there's a project out there for someone to at least hit up like Wikipedia and beef up some of these niche movie descriptions so they're more useful.
I'm in the position where I'm like feeling like that might be us and I'm trying to deny it. So
I am worrying that we have the moral responsibility to be doing this. So yes. All right.
Well, anyway. I think the first challenge though would be to actually get a good translation of this movie so you could then write properly about it.
Did anyone watch a good translation of this movie?
No, I watched with the AI generated. Yeah. So for people who are really sweating bullets about AI, I have to say, it's not that I disagree with you, but when I watch the auto translation of a film like this, I saved a couple of my best bits, but it makes me feel a little better. How about that?
Yeah. So this was the first movie we watched where I couldn't quite do it because I needed the subtitles to be there to help me figure out who the characters' names were.
Which didn't help.
But I was like 95% of the way to turning off the subtitles. I only speak rudimentary Spanish and just seeing if I could appreciate this movie without understanding the dialogue. And right. I bet I could have like 80% appreciated it is my sense.
Yeah. Yes. I think it detracted, but for me, it made it possible to follow it at all.
Yes,
so.
Exactly. So,
yeah.
All right. This is where we usually talk about the historical context, what's going on. The year is 1963. John and I have a special episode about the 60s coming out very soon that is going to dive more deeply into what was scaring people in the 60s and who was going to see these movies and wanting to be scared by them. But I am not going to go into that now. And also this movie was made in Mexico, and my knowledge of Mexican history in the 60s is pretty weak. We did touch on a little bit of the history of Mexican film in this era a couple of episodes ago in our episode where we talked about Santo versus the Zombies. So yes, if you do want a little bit of history of Mexican, the golden age of Mexican cinema, go check out that episode. We're not going to repeat it on this one. So that's what I got for historical context, which is to say I got nothing. John, do you want to start us out by giving us a 60-second or something close to 60 seconds overview of La Cabeza Viviente?
Yeah, that shouldn't. I don't think it'll be too hard. That it's got a very tried and true plot. So with a couple of small twists, the movie opens with an ancient Aztec ceremony, in which case they are ensuring the head of a great leader and warrior is preserved. And in his tomb, he has buried with him the high priestess of the moon and his own high priest, who are then discovered hundreds of years later by three explorers who violate the tomb. And the explorers discover that those who violate the tomb will be cursed. So the most of the rest of the movie, we watch as these three are slowly eliminated by the high priest and the high priestess, who they thought were mummies but are in fact not. It's complicated a little bit by the fact that the daughter of one of the explorers is the spitting image or reincarnation of the high priestess of the moon, as is her boyfriend, the spitting image of the dead warrior's head. So in any case, the movie ends with both of them resisting the urge to complete the curse and make the final sacrifice of her father. And then all is well. Did I cover the basics there, Eddie?
That was perfect. This is a movie that dares to ask, how many ritualistic Aztec sacrificial murders would have to happen in your house before you started to connect them to the perfectly preserved Aztec mummy you just brought and are storing in your basement?
Additionally, when you find repeatedly blood dripping from the mummy's knife, yes.
I asked my wife this question. She said it would take about three, which would be about on par for this movie. What about you guys?
I would have at least put a lock on the door after the first one.
Yes. I would have taken I would have felt silly about it, but I would have taken a precaution pretty much after the first.
I won't sleep with the closet door open at the age of 55. So, you know, yeah.
And when you say mummy, I think most people envision wrap bandages, withered skin. This looks like a preserved human.
Yeah.
Yes, it looks so like.
It looks like it could move and do damage. Yes. It doesn't look like a mummy.
So let's make that point. The mummies don't look like mummies. They function like zombies. Sort of to the point about your Terminator, right?
Yes.
The high priest, who is the sort of primary zombie, yeah, is not like a mummy, even though they call him a mummy. And we'll get to that.
Yeah,
in detail,
We'll get into it. All right. So I'm going to be leading the discussion on this one, and just a little bit of a caveat. I only understood about 50% of the dialogue of this film between my rudimentary Spanish and trying to make sense of the horrible hash that was the auto translate. So I do apologize if I am about to butcher the plot of a movie you love dearly, because I can't speak the language. So, but right. I will do my best, and I'm relying on you two to help me out here. So,
well, does that mean since I don't have any Spanish that I only understand 25%?
I don't know how you would have understood more than that, but maybe you have a special insight into this is a movie where it's not, there's some weird convoluted stuff, but generally speaking, it's not like,
it's pretty straightforward. It's
like a pretty straightforward plot. I mean, like every night the mummy goes and kills another person. You can get the basics of it without knowing any of the dialogue that's going on. But
and they spend a lot of time lingering over the visual clues.
Oh my gosh, yes.
Of how the mummy is doing this and how the live humans are missing it. So, you know, it's not that confusing. But I'm sure there's much we missed outside.
Yeah. Well, let me dive into it, guys. You two keep me on track, keep me from going down rabbit trails that aren't productive. I do want to talk about this opening segment. I do think that this is not the first like prologue of a zombie movie we've seen where they're sort of setting up what's going to happen to the rest of the movie.
Right.
I do wonder, is this our first historical prologue?
I feel like it is. First of all, I feel like they're filming partially at an ancient site. I don't know that it's an Aztec site, but there is something about it, and there do seem to be actual people. So it has that strong feeling. There's clearly some actual footage going on here.
And it's like a 10-minute scene. It's not like a minute and a half quick prologue. It's like a whole scene with multiple right. characters and dialogue. Let me talk about it a bit. So as the opening credits roll, as we see a bunch of stock video of some ancient ruins and pyramids, I tried to dig around to see what these pyramids were. I was able to identify, I think, a couple of them. One of them is El Castillo, also called the Temple of Kukulkan, which is in the Yucatan. And that is a really famous landmark of the Mayan civilization, not Aztec at all. So I think we're definitely getting some B-roll ancient ruin footage here. But then we do see the Pyramid of the Sun, which is a famous structure near Mexico City. It was in the ancient city of Teotihuacan, which they were contemporaries of the Mayans, which I think was like a millennia before the Aztecs, although I might be off. So anyway, this movie is ostensibly about some Aztec mummies, but they're playing pretty fast and loose. So that might answer my question before about whether there was any more attempted fidelity to these cultures than you would get in Hollywood. Probably not, right?
Right.
So the point of this prologue, John, you already summed it up pretty well, so I don't need to belabor it, but we do meet three important characters, our kind of quasi-villains in this movie. They are, and you do not want to know how long it took me to figure out the name of the Aztec warrior who's being buried, because the translation kept referring to him as a cat.
Yes, God bless you, because I couldn't figure out what
45 minutes
name.
Into the movie, I did some Googling and I found some online discussion of this that helped me understand that the name of the Aztec warrior who's being entombed here is Acatl. So,
all right.
He has been beheaded. And a part of the ceremony of entombing him is they are ritually sacrificing the person that killed him. So,
right.
But two people are being buried alive with Acatl. They are, as John mentioned, they are the high priest, whose name is, and forgive my pronunciation, please tweet us and let me know what we're getting wrong here. But it's Chiu, X-I-U, as I saw it. He's the Aztec priest. And an Aztec priestess, who I'm going to pronounce her name as Cochicatzel.
Okay.
They are both buried alive. And
you don't want to brush past the part where the guy pulls a heart out of the body and holds it up.
You know,
you?
I was going to rush past that, but let's talk about it. So,
yeah, this has nothing to do with zombies, but does have to do with being gnarly. So
this is not the first time this is going to happen in this movie, John. So tell us when we say someone is ritually murdered by an Aztec mummy, what is actually happening?
Yeah, so what they do is they make a sort of a crosswise incision right over the heart, and then they pull the heart out. And in this first scene, they actually hold it up as a sort of sacrament almost. In the future, we don't actually see the removal. We just see it sitting there. They imply that it's still beating because there's blood coming out of it, but they didn't have the effects budget to make it actually look like it's beating.
Yeah.
So at least it's normal size.
Yeah. It's a little
It's gross. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's not super gory. It's,
yeah, we're getting more gross.
Yeah, but we are getting more gross. And later in the movie, we are going to see like the incisions being made in at least one murder scene, which feels like pushing the envelope for these films. But
is this the first film to have organs removed and shown held in a hand?
I feel like they did that in Dr. Blood's coffin.
Yeah.
But I'm not sure they were actually removed. Didn't they take out the guy's heart in Dr. Blood's coffin?
Yes.
The guy who was still alive. Remember?
Yeah.
He was doing the quote-unquote autopsy.
We saw organs being removed in Dr. Blood's coffin.
Yeah.
So maybe not new, but this is pretty close to like the Temple of Doom scene. Pretty honestly. All right. So they are all buried alive, but critically, a piece of jewelry is given to the priestess Cochicatzel as she's buried. This is alternately called by the subtitles The Ring of Death or The Eye of Death.
But and it's a ring with an eye on it.
It's a big ring. It looks, it's huge. It's like the size of a fist.
Yeah.
And it looks like a secret decoder type of thing you would order from a cereal box.
That's exactly the note I made. It's a secret decoder ring.
Yeah. It has a light that pulses on, you know, when its evil is being activated, and is accompanied by like a computer sounding like boop noise.
Yes. Yeah.
Which is pretty delightful, honestly. It takes them a very long time to connect the weird happenings to the beeping giant ring of death that one of the characters is wearing. But
and how that character got that ring is a little hand wavy. So
we yes. So then we get a little time skip montage. The first date. This is where we learn that this was definitely Aztecs because we get the date 1525. John, does that ring? What happened in 1525?
Isn't that when Cortez first contacted the Aztecs?
I think that's when he killed the last Aztec
emperor.
Oh,
okay. All right.
So that, yeah, we get a montage through the centuries until all the way up to the exciting modern year of 1963.
That's right.
So John, why don't you describe, as we open on 1963, what is the scene we see?
The scene we see is three explorers sort of walking on a temple, and they're trying to pry open a door. And they, one of them has a pith helmet, so bonus points for that. And they pry open this ancient door, which was sealed shut in this tomb, and they find the scene featuring the high priest and the high priestess and the head on a table inside of this tomb.
Yes. I got to ask, because this is the second movie in a row with, no, the second movie recently with really over-the-top cobwebs. Do cobwebs really get that thick?
Like, I don't think so. Blankets? I think it became, it's sort of like, you know, how silencers don't actually sound like they do in the movie, or chloroform works in 5 seconds. Like,
yeah.
It seems to be one of those things where it's such a good horror convention. People just do it.
I think so. Know? I mean, I love it. So, we later do get a spider, which I want to save the discussion for it till that moment, because it's a real highlight. Ooh,
terrifying, so, that yes. Spider. Yes.
Yeah. So we get some cool Indiana Jones vibes here, I think. And they find the preserved head of a cottle in within a scary skull mask.
Yeah. Can I just say?
Yeah.
Like in an attempt to avoid capturing just example after example of bad AI translation of this movie, I did highlight one just so I could get it out of my system. When they read the inscription, they say a great military dignitary and an axe knight. So,
so that is a coddle. So they find two other weird things in here. One is the perfectly preserved body of the priestess Kocha Quetzal, who is standing right against the wall. However, yes, no sooner do they discover her when her body disintegrates into dust and vanishes,
right,
essentially, leaving only the ring of death that she was wearing. Right?
Which really threw me, to be honest, because I was like, well, boy, that was a lot of effort to bring this person all the way, you know, hundreds of years into the future, just to have them dissipate yeah immediately. So
I kind of liked the way they had her just crumble, as if once the sort of hermetically sealed chamber of this tomb was broken, like this some sort of stasis was, like, anyway.
Right.
But they also find the perfectly, and I do mean perfectly preserved, corpse of Chiu, the high priest. He does not disassemble into dust, and he is, I mean, it's just like he's a guy
who's sleeping.
He's So since this is our mummy, John, or at least one of them, let's talk for a minute about Chiu. What does he look like? Does he look like a zombie? Why do they call him a mummy? Like, what are we dealing with here?
So he moves like a zombie. That's the only really zombie-like thing about him. And he is also indestructible in the way you described earlier. So yes, those are his two sort of zombie aspects. Though I think the mummy is also indestructible in that way, if I recall that film. It's been a long time.
I don't remember the mummy, but I imagine that it is, right?
Yeah. So both are not, you can't stop them with bullets, that kind of thing. But he can speak and he has agency later in the film. So in that way, he doesn't seem like, he is bound to this curse, but he can make decisions and choices about how to execute it, I guess is what I'd say. So in that way, he doesn't seem like a zombie. But to look at him, he just looks like a zombie and not actually a mummy because he doesn't have any of the trappings we associate with mummies, you know?
And he usually shambles slowly in a familiar zombie gait.
But he can move
at like normal human speed when the script calls for it.
Yes. And he carries an obsidian dagger that he refuses to let go.
That's right. They try to pry it from his hands and he won't let go.
That's right.
I mean, you have to imagine that some questions were raised by the perfect preservation of this corpse, right? But
yes.
For the first of maybe 700 times in this movie, the camera lingers on the head of a coddle as when no one is looking, it slowly opens its eyes, looks around, and the head is not as sinister as I think it's supposed to be because he looks like he's wearing a smug grin most of the time.
And just to describe it, like he's got a bandage over his nose, which I don't quite understand. And his headdress is like that of a hawk or something. So it's like open. It's an open hawk's mouth and his face is inside of that.
Yes.
And it's covered by a ceremonial mask, which sort of comes and goes as needed.
Yes. All right, so I had a devil of a time keeping straight the characters of the archaeology team. So I'm going to list them out now. I'm going to propose that we not get too tripped up over who was who because it doesn't really matter.
I was giving you a hard time because I got all of the foreign language films early on, so I didn't have to do clips. And I was like, well, you finally get one. And of course, it has a translation that makes it almost impossible to follow.
Yes.
So sorry about that.
That's fine. I think we have a total of we have five people who are going to kind of be our hero party, I think, of this movie.
Yeah.
The head of this expedition that has desecrated this Aztec tomb is Professor Mueller or Miller or Muller, depending on what subtitle you're reading and how your comprehension of Spanish is. He is going to be around for most of the movie. He has a couple of teammates or like fellow professors or research assistants. It's a little vague. One of them is a Professor Urquizo.
Yes. Later in the film, the translation picks up Urquizo and associates that name with the head.
Yes.
It's very confusing.
But
yes, Professor Urquizo.
Another one is a guy named Rivas. He's going to be our first to die.
Yep.
And then lastly, we have Roberto, who's an archaeologist or a research assistant to Mueller. And he is, I think, a couple with Marta. And wouldn't you know it, we have another beautiful scientist's daughter or scholar's daughter, right? This is definitely a trope we should start tracking.
Yeah.
And that is Marta, and she and Roberto are a couple. Does someone give Marta the ring at some point here?
So a couple things about Marta. First of all, she has the ring, and they don't say anything about it until later in the film. They say, when your father gave you that ring. So just to be clear, the professor gave her a creepy old ring from an Aztec tomb. And nobody thought to mention it or connect it with anything that's going on with an eyeball on it, just to say. Secondly,
when I was doing archaeology work in the 90s, that would have been bad field practice.
Would have gotten fired or forbidden ever from doing archaeology
and maybe
again.
Extradited to another country to face trial. But yes.
But also Marta is the spitting image of the high priestess, which nobody comments on, but she clearly is. She just is it's the same actress.
The same actress.
Played the high priest.
So is Acadal the same actor as Roberto?
It is, but they don't reveal it until the end of the movie.
Okay.
Because he's got this thing on his face and you can't quite see it. But then when they point it out, you're like, oh, yeah. So.
All right. Well, I'm going to skip ahead here because I don't want us to get too bogged down in stuff that doesn't matter. So I've introduced our party. You don't need to remember their names. The subtitles certainly don't, and I promise I'll stop ripping on the subtitles because that's got to be getting tedious. All right.
Right.
The important thing is, though, that Marta is wearing the ring, and this is going to be the kind of a catalyst for a lot of problems. We cut to what I would say, guys, was the best and strongest scene in this entire movie, mm-hmm. and that is we get a fairly long scene where Marta, clearly troubled by something but unable to articulate it, is walking out on the balcony or the roof of her house and looking out at the modern Mexico City skyline.
Yes. This is maybe the one scene where where it feels like the same director as the revived monster.
Exactly.
Right? I mean, that same vibe that we picked up on.
So, yeah, I was waiting for this because so far the movie has a definitely lower quality filmmaking feel to it. But yes. You get these little glimpses of like, okay, these are people that when they are on fire can turn out something interesting. What's interesting about this is where you start to realize, or where I started to realize, that Marta is either the reincarnation of the priestess, Coach Quetzal, or the ring is somehow causing the priestess's spirit to possess her body. None of this is conveyed through dialogue, and that's good. It's conveyed entirely through her facial expressions, which is a remarkable piece of acting. Yeah. You can see her struggling with something. You can see her entranced by, but overwhelmed by the modern skyline of a modern metropolis. Mm-hmm. And it's just quite well done. I guess I won't belabor any further. The plot is about to kick into motion. Before our first ritual sacrifice here in a second, is there anything you want to call attention to about the way this movie has set up its plot that I haven't?
I think it's good. They don't explain what I like is they don't explain, as far as I know, they don't explain why Marta is the spitting image of this high priestess, and they never really do.
They don't. No.
But I kind of enjoy that continuity because I think just it makes it an engaging and mysterious movie. But also to the point of her performance. Later in the movie, she'll have these things where she's almost sort of fast switching between Marta in modernity and this high priestess, and she'll have to do it in the middle of the scene. And
yes.
And so she has to convey this, like she'll be in this trance-like state of the high priestess and then a moment later be Marta again. And it's all just through the power of her acting, which I thought was pretty good.
Agreed. She's the only character in this movie who's really asked to act like this, I think. And anyway, she's a solid choice.
Yeah.
All right. I should note that they're all staying in Professor Mueller's house, where he has a big artifact room where he has stored the Aztec mummies and all the paraphernalia, including the head and the perfectly
preserved head, the ring, and the Aztec mummy are all at his house.
Exactly. Yeah. All right. So here is
where I think we call this a gentleman explorer. These feel like the English gentleman explorers we've run into before.
Oh, totally. Yes. So the movie's plot kicks off in earnest here because we get our first modern day murder.
Yes.
And while Marta's out on the roof, this isn't visually conveyed very well, but she feels something dripping on her and she thinks it's water. And she looks up and it's actually blood because Rivas, one of the people on the archaeology team, has been murdered, his chest cut open and his heart removed. And that did make me wonder, where did the trope of like something's dripping on you and then you slowly look up and it's something awful?
Yes, start? It's pretty well done here.
Yeah. So Rivas has been murdered. Everybody freaks out. I don't know how accurate this was, but the subtitles lay it out very clearly as someone says, "This man has all the characteristics of being sacrificed according to an Aztec rite." So in case Correct. You have missed that because you're the least observant film viewer.
And also his heart shows up.
Yeah, to make matters worse, they find his heart's been removed from his chest and they find it still fresh with blood on it next on the little plate. A coddle's head sits on a little platter,
right.
And the heart of his victims, of the mummy's victims, appear on this plate.
Right, still oozing blood.
And they notice that the mummy, Chiu, is back in his coffin, but he's holding his obsidian knife is dripping fresh blood. So,
and they see this, and they're like, "Well, that's just superstition." I'm like, "He's holding a knife; it's dripping blood. Come on." This happens multiple times in the movie, and I'm sorry. I normally understand and sympathize with that viewpoint and the tension that creates, but on this one, I was like, "Guys,
yeah,
like he's so, literally holding the murder weapon."
And yeah, so you hit on a key fact about this movie that this happens multiple times, and I want to say for about like 40 minutes here, this movie just sort of treads water. We get one or two more murders. people have the same repetitive conversation of like, do you think it's the curse? No, it couldn't be. We live in a modern time.
Right.
Don't be superstitious. So I...
Except for instead of saying that, the subtitles tell us it says something about drinking wine from the recursive mummy or something. So yes, but carry on.
All right. So let me scan ahead to... So the archaeologists confer at some point and they all are basically like, hey, you guys remember that curse? Do you think that this is the curse? They are all inclined to say no, but they also start hypothesizing who among them is going to be the next victim. So
right.
I guess you might say they are struggling with credulity here. And we get a lot of scenes where like someone visits the mummy and while it's not looking, its eyes open and then it closes them. And that happens about 800 times.
Right.
I do want to mention one time that Mueller goes down into the storeroom alone to investigate Akatl's head, because this is where we get our spider. So he takes off Akatl's face mask.
Yes.
And the world's most hilariously fake looking tarantula crawls out, and by crawls I mean was dragged by a wire.
Well, eventually it crawls a little and then it just sort of flops
over on the ground, like they lost control of it or pulled it.
Akatl
and Chiu continually opening and closing
he just leaves
eyes.
It like
yes,
like he's used to having a giant spider in his house, like yes. I mean, the one time I went to Mexico, I did see a tarantula on the side of like a giant water bottle, and people were freaked out. Like, it's not like just because they live there, it's like, oh, that's tarantulas, no problem. Like, that's not a thing.
I used to, when I lived in Southern California, we had a tarantula problem in our house.
And, God.
Maybe one day I'll tell you my tarantula story. But
you know, I just had a coworker who like stepped in a hornet's nest and like got attacked. Ooh. And they were like, I was like, what? That's my worst nightmare. Like, you're laughing. Sorry, carry on.
All right. Well, the movie... I would say this movie's pace kind of gets sluggish here. So I want to skip to one kind of important plot thing here. John, interrupt me if this is not what you were about to mention. We do at some point get our first scene where we actually see Chiu, the zombie mummy, leaving his coffin and walking plottily around the house. And this is interesting because... For the first time, he does this sort of ritualistic call to his god. He has sort of a prayer he intones as he is, the gist of it is, you know, I'm going to serve you by killing the people that have desecrated your tombs.
Right.
He references a lot of Aztec gods. I don't know if they're real ones or not. And he calls, I didn't know, was he supposed to be like in love with that high priestess?
No, I don't think so, because I think the love relationship is between the severed head and the high priestess.
Okay,
because later it's revealed that Roberto is the appearance of the severed head and Marta is the appearance of the high priestess, and they are a couple in both time frames.
Got it.
Yeah.
Well, the point of the scene is that Siu calls on the priestess to return to life. And we cut over to Marta, where the ring begins to blink and make that beeping sound. And this establishes that, if you didn't figure it out by now, that Marta is kind of being possessed by or reincarnated by the priestess. And she can be kind of controlled by the ring or by Ziu's chants, because he summons her down into the mummy room, and she kind of submissively goes down there.
And participates in the second, or tries to participate in the second murder.
Yes.
Yes. What's interesting, though, is later somebody else has the ring, and they can be controlled, but Marta can still kind of be controlled. So it's not a super clear distinction.
Yeah, and Siu is, I didn't even remember how I was going to pronounce that name, so I apologize if I've been saying that name different all the time. Siu, or Chiu, He treats Marta with real contempt when she is kind of being controlled by the ring, which I thought was interesting.
As he does in the before times, in ancient Aztec times, he sort of like we sort of left this out, but she, when she is the high priestess, doesn't want to live forever in this tomb.
Yes.
And he makes her.
Yeah.
And it's the sort of the similar relationship in the quote unquote modern world.
Well, the next victim is Professor Urquizu, Urquizo.
Yes.
And Marta kind of participates somewhat in this murder. So Marta is carrying the head
carries
around.
She carries the head.
She's walking around the house with Chiyu, and Urquizo is in the library doing some research.
Now, this is the one time somebody leaves the house. Urquizo does actually go to his own house, and Roberto takes him there.
Oh, is that?
Yes.
Oh, okay. That makes
sense. That's the one person who doesn't live in this house.
Okay. That makes sense why Chiyu then appears outside a door which has like metal bars on it, and he bends open the bars, forces his way into the house.
Like a Terminator.
Exactly like a Terminator. He advances on Urquizo. Urquizo pulls out a gun, wielding it, like holding it close to his hip, as you do. And there's a regular human speed chase through the house. And Marta is there. Urquizo takes a bunch of gunshots at Chiyu with no effect. And Chiyu grabs him, pins him down, calls out to his gods, and then cuts open his chest.
Yes.
And I wouldn't say this is gross, but it's a little more than I expected because you see the knife go in and like make some cuts. So again, not super graphic or gross, but, and then this scene ends with Marta waking up screaming as if she's just had a terrible dream. So when she's being forced to participate in these Aztec murders, she's in a sort of fugue state of being controlled is the idea.
Yeah. And later in the film, Chiyu will say, you know, as he's doing his invocation, you know, make it so that she doesn't remember actively participating in this thing.
That's
right. We sort of get an explanation of why she doesn't remember.
So this is the point at which, well, do you have any other comments? So this is our second zombie kill of the movie. Mm-hmm. Any comments or observations we haven't touched on already?
No, I think I think there's a lot of interesting stuff going in here in terms of Marta's possession and her remembering it as a dream. And I found this really intriguing. It's just the problem is it's dragged out because she admits the same thing happened to me with Rivas, the first victim. And then she's going to get drawn into the third crime, though she's going to throw the ring out the window.
Yes.
When she gets home.
So that's the next. This is a plot important thing she does when she gets home. She does chuck the ring of death out the window, but through a wacky coincidence, Roberto, her boyfriend, for some reason is out driving. He stops, he notices the ring of death on the ground, and he picks it up, and it's going to be important in this movie's finale that he is now wearing or at least possessing the ring because he is now vulnerable to control, the mummy's control.
Right.
So let's see. They go through kind of a very similar post-mortem type set of discussions. The police are now here. There's a couple police inspectors who are asking questions. Marta tries to explain that like she saw Urquizo's death.
Mm-hmm.
And she even goes so far as to basically lay out the story that these men are being killed in revenge for desecrating the tomb. And she even says she was forced to participate, but no one really believes her. It's a lot of like, calm down, honey.
We look at the dripping knife again.
They find Urquizo's heart near Cottle's head, just like with Rivas's. And then that bloody obsidian dagger in Chiyu's hand. Chiyu is, after these murders, Chiyu is always back in his coffin, clutching the obsidian knife. I did note that we haven't talked about the soundtrack yet. It is mostly forgettable, but there are a couple of specific scenes that have what I wrote down in my notes as cool piano music.
I remember that music too. Yeah, yes. It was pretty good.
Yeah. It's mostly just that it was unique and interesting from the rest of the movie soundtrack, which is like incredibly generic 50s, 60s.
I wondered if it was all sort of stock music.
The composer is Gustavo Carrione, and he has 373 credits.
Oh man.
So I don't know how many of those are original music or repurposing his own music. I don't know, but he's done a lot.
Well, given that James Horner's written one soundtrack and spun it off 20 times, I imagine I imagine this guy might have reused a little bit.
So believe it or not, we're closing in on the kind of final act of this film. So just to get our bearings here, we have, Roberto is still alive.
Yep.
So is his girlfriend, Marta, and her dad, Professor Mueller, is still alive and still doesn't believe that it's the mummy.
Right.
Is that, that's all that's left at this point of the surviving party. Is that right?
That's right.
Okay.
Yes. Two are dead, three are alive.
And so remember Roberto's...
Plus the inspector.
Roberto still has that ring. He hasn't really revealed that to anyone.
No, and it's now just in his pocket.
Yeah.
The which means he lived in a time when suit jackets had real pockets.
Yes. The police are now staking out the house. But they are focused, of course, on an external murderer and not at the one that lives in the basement of the house that they're staking out. The mummy wakes up and staggers around, and Chiu once again summons the wearer of the ring of death or the eye of death. But this time, so Marta does answer his summons, even though she doesn't have the ring anymore.
Right.
I guess because she's the reincarnation of the priestess, or else maybe the influence of the ring lingers after you wear it. And Chiu, in a real villainous moment, he really kind of gloatingly mocks the fact that he's going to order Marta to kill her own father, Professor Mueller.
That's right.
And she resists. So the father wakes up and begs her to stop.
Yes.
To kind of come to her senses. And she doesn't entirely snap out of it, but she does just enough to kind of drop the knife and hesitate.
Yes.
A policeman then enters the room, takes a bunch of shots at Chiu, but Chiu is, of course, unfazed by the shots, and he brutally strangles the police officer. So we have another body now. By the time the others arrive, Marta and Chiu are both gone, and they've taken Mueller with them. So we have this dead cop and Roberta, who doesn't know what's happened to his girlfriend or her father.
Until?
So then we kind of cut to what's our final scene. Chiu and Marta have hauled her father down into another part of the house. This house is like enormous. Much people walk all around this house. It's crazy. All right. But Professor Mueller wakes up. He's begging for his daughter to stop and not kill him. And conflicted, she finally just faints like it's too much for her.
Right. She drops the knife and faints dramatically.
But this doesn't foil Chiu's plan, because the ring of death now can be used to claim Roberto. So
yes, who puts it on once he realizes he has it.
He does. It is real Tolkien-esque, you know, one ring.
I was going to say
stuff here.
Yeah.
And so with the ring on and blinking and making that cute booping noise, he responds to the summons and heads in down into the room where he is now ordered to kill Marta, his girlfriend. So Chiu is basically a jerk. Like it's not enough for him to just kill these people. He's got to make it like personal in the worst way, right?
Yeah.
Chiu also, if he's gonna hatch these like really ambitiously evil plots, he needs to make sure he has the power to make this happen. And so he's already failed with Marta, and he fails again because Roberto just can't quite bring himself to kill the love of his life, right?
Right.
So then the police charge in, and then I'm going to need a little help about what happened here. So, John, can you describe this movie's final moments for us?
So what happens is Chiu decides he's going to kill both Marta and Roberto because he's just sort of frustrated that the plans haven't worked out, because he claims that this final sacrifice has to be committed by a loved one, and the two loved ones won't do it. So what happens?
It's a problem.
It's a problem. Yeah. And so the head sort of wakes up and speaks for the first time and says, "Don't you recognize Roberto and Marta?" And we get this montage and realization that the head looks just like Roberto, and we already knew Marta looks just like the high priestess. And it sort of ends the curse, and the mummy becomes mortal, because when the police shoot him, he actually dies and he turns to dust.
Yeah. He staggers away. Like he's lost his invincibility and he's lost his purpose. Right. I mean,
yeah,
I think he's just been told he's screwed this up, I think.
Yes. And I think the point was not that the curse be carried out, but somehow these lovers be reunited in the future.
Okay.
Like, I think the movie's actually sentimental and is trying to say, now that this has happened, the curse is over.
I will confess I don't totally understand why the head. So is the head orchestrating these murders, or is this Chiu kind of doing his own thing?
I think it's the head orchestrating the murders, but I don't know why the head puts a stop to it.
Yeah, there are times when the head, the eyes open, it looks at the zombie, and then the zombie begins whatever it's going to, its actions.
Right.
So it gives the appearance that the head is controlling the zombie. But then there are other times when the zombie just moves on its own. So yeah, it's unclear.
I wondered if, like, Chiyo is always invoking, like, these gods of darkness and stuff. And I wondered if he is kind of gone rogue, or is misinterpreting his job.
Right.
But either way, he's clearly not supposed to kill the reincarnation of Akadal and the priestess.
This is where our inability to speak Spanish and the complete lack of the complete lack of coherent subtitles makes it impossible to noodle this out.
Yes, but you're right. This movie does want this ending to feel sentimental, because
yes,
Akadal's head gives like a satisfied smile before vanishing away.
And turning then into dust.
Chiyu's body turns to dust, but amusingly leaves a big, like, human outline on the floor, which I actually really liked.
Well, so I think what happens, though, is what I think the catalyst for this is this inspector actually destroys the ring.
Yes.
And that causes this to be broken. So if I were to, if I were to sort of reverse engineer what happened at the beginning of the movie, it's this actual ring of death that is the driver of all of this immortality and sacrifice, and once that's destroyed, the head can rest, Chichu can rest, and the lovers from ancient times are reunited like Lady Hawk.
Yeah, so the ring is like the evil, this is like an evil artifact.
Yes, it may be the ring that is the villain here.
Yeah,
I guess.
And then that's really our ending. Roberto and Marta, kind of as the curse is done and they've both snapped out of it, they kiss, and then we get a fiend
across
the, and that is a wrap on La Cabeza Viviente. Did we miss anything important? Did I skip over anything that was really cool?
No, I mean, there's some cool bits here, but I think we caught them all. One thing that is a little sad for me about this movie versus the revived monster is that, the revived monster had similar limitations in terms of budget and scale, but somehow made that more dramatic. And here a lot of the scenes just feel like very flat 1960s sitcom sort of filming. You know what I mean? Like, yeah, a lot of that invention is sort of missing. And I know you can't make movies the same way forever, but it feels like a step down in terms of creativity, production creativity.
It feels like there's too much filler in this one.
Yes.
Like, there's a whole lot of scenes that don't really leave any impact on you.
Right. They're really extended by Marta staring off into space for like a whole minute, you know?
So, yeah, I would agree. This isn't a terrible film, but it feels like just a pretty unremarkable one. I guess we can get to that, though, in a few minutes. Let's go into our wrap-up questions. What's that?
The director, Urrieta, this was his third film from 1963, and he did five the year before.
Oh, wow.
So I don't know how much time they're spending on the details.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
The script has a sort of workmanlike, feel to it. There's,
yes.
Although who knows what the script really was, because. All right, John, La Cabeza Viviente, is there a hero party?
There is. I think it's pretty clear. It's the three explorers, or the four explorers, Roberto, Marta, and the three that discovered the tomb.
Yes. Yeah, I think so too. And how do they do? How many survive?
Well, two of them get knocked off. This is not unlike Curse of the Doll People. Like, most of the movie is figuring out how the curse is going to be executed, and these people are going to get killed. Like, the only one who gets saved is the last one.
Yeah, and like Curse of the Doll People, the victims are kind of aware of that they're in line to be killed, right? Even if they don't entirely believe it, and they have open discussions about which of us is going to be next.
Yeah.
All right. So what type of zombie strain are we dealing with here?
So, interesting question. It's not exactly like any other zombie, because it feels less like a zombie. But the one thing I would say is the vibe of the horror, I think, goes back to the curse of immortality.
Hmm.
In the sense of the very old early zombie movies we watched. Maybe that's a little bit of a stretch, but that's what it feels like to me, where the horror is being the zombie. Obviously, being killed by the zombie is also a horror, but I think if you take it that Akadal's head sort of achieves some sort of peace at last, you know, from his curse of immortality, then immortality or zombiedom as a curse is really sort of the strain that I see here. What do you take that the same way?
I agree with that. Do you think that Marta and Roberto are zombies in the way that, say, the protagonists of White Zombie were zombies? They were
controlled because
by kind of a quote zombie master for part of the film and ordered to turn on each other.
And then return to normal humanity. So I would say, yeah, I would make that comparison actually.
Okay.
For sure.
So there's no zombie horde here really.
No.
How are zombies destroyed or killed?
The curse has to be broken. You can't just kill them. They try multiple times and it doesn't work.
Is the world threatened in this movie?
I don't think so.
I don't think so either. Yeah, this is a you went where you weren't supposed to go and now you're paying the price sort of movie. All right, John, are there any, and Brad, are there any new strains or zombie firsts we should call out? Anything that worked its way into the zombie evolution going forward?
I feel like immortality is curse isn't really... It's done in a different way here, but I don't feel like it's unique enough to be considered a first. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, and remember we had Zombies of Mura Tau, where we had zombies kind of cursed to live until the curse of the whatever, the diamonds. I forget the details, but
this is the first historical prologue, which sets up the movie.
That's true.
Yep. Okay, we'll give it that.
I'll take that.
Yep. I also added the first evil artifact.
Which
I don't think we've had before. You mentioned that earlier, Andy.
Okay. Yeah, sort of in the Zombies of Mura Tau, there's the diamonds, which destroying them release the curse, but the diamonds aren't malevolent in the way that this ring is. So I think you're right, Brad.
Is this our first Central American zombie?
Maybe, because the other zombies that were referred to in, you know, when we were in the...
No, it can't be, because we had Santo versus the zombies.
Right.
I guess maybe these zombies are connected to Aztec culture.
Yes, we've had South American zombies in previous films, but that is not, Aztecs are not South American, they're Central American.
Yeah. So I don't know if that's exactly a first, but we are, and I should note, they call the zombie a mummy. So I don't think this movie is even thinking of itself necessarily as a zombie film, but it is kind of interesting that we're...
And it has all the tropes of a mummy film, right? The curse, the saving the survivors, all of that kind of stuff.
So the famous mummy is from Egypt. And then we have a series of movies about the Aztec mummy. Is that like this guy? Like, he's not in bandages? Does he look like this?
I mean, I know there's a series of Aztec mummy horror movies. I don't know anything about them, though. And I don't know that the Aztecs mummified their dead, or if that's just a conflagration of Egypt and Aztecs. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't think they did, but...
A quick Google search shows, like, withered skin, disfigured face for the mummy, for the Aztec mummy.
Okay.
Okay. Huh. Just as a practical point, like the air isn't as dry in Central America as it is in Egypt, so I think creating a mummy would be much more difficult.
Yeah. Well, hey, let's move on to your four pillars of the zombie genre, John.
Yes.
In La Cabeza Viviente, is there an apocalypse?
No, no apocalypse.
I agree. I think it has a tenuous connection to an apocalypse in the past, if we think about the fall of the Aztec Empire, but not in the sense that we asked this question.
Right.
Is there a contagion in this movie?
No, I don't think there's a contagion, but the ring does, the possessor of the ring can become sort of zombie-esque. So
yes,
it's not contagion. One zombie can't create another zombie.
Are there tough moral choices in this one?
I don't think so, other than...
A few people are forced to do something that they don't want to do.
Yes.
That doesn't quite feel like it.
The main character expresses regret for desecrating the tomb at the end, but he didn't have a lot of trouble doing it in the beginning. So I think it's more like a moral lesson than a tough moral choice.
And lastly, this should be good. Does this movie feature loved ones turning against you?
Yeah, it's the central plot of the third act of the film. Will Marta kill her father? Will Roberto kill Marta? can this evil device and this evil magic force them to turn against their loved ones? And in both cases, it's a near miss, but it doesn't end up happening.
I find it to be a cop-out when people can just like resist this this sort of thing through force of will.
Yes.
To me, that takes the edge off of what's happening, but it's also very common. So,
yeah.
All right. And then lastly, John, I will ask you, did the movie's poster sell this movie accurately? And if you want to refresh your memory, the poster for La Cabeza Viviente features a coddle's head on a platter that is actually a little bloodier than the actual one we see in the movie.
Yeah, for sure.
In the bottom right, we see Chiu, the high priest and our main mummy. And in the top left, we see Marta clad much more scantily than she is in the actual film, wielding an obsidian dagger.
Yeah, I mean, I'd say yes, it does sell it. We got exactly, it's right what's on the tin there, which is a strange thing for
yes.
Yeah.
I'm pleased that I think I mentioned this last week when we first looked at this poster. I'm pleased that they don't really make the head look menacing or scary. It's got that, it looks like it's having a pleasant nap.
Yes. And, yeah, agreed.
Okay. All right, then. John, did you have any questions? We are past the 50s, so I don't know how many of our 50s questions are really relevant here.
I'm going to consider this our sort of last movie of the 50s in a way, because I think we both agree, and we'll talk about this in our 60s episode, that 50s really become the 60s in about 63. However, is paranoia, conformity, or dark secrets a theme here?
No, not really, except that this is one movie in a long tradition at this point, I think, of cautionary tales about messing with things you shouldn't be messing with, like with of bringing your modern tools and your modern science and your modern exploration into places that that really you don't belong. So that's not hypocrisy. That's not a dark secret exactly. That's more like, I feel like that's, you know, that is sort of a collective Western subconscious guilt about what we did when we kind of intruded into all of these native cultures all over the world.
Right.
So
did our heroes change? Are they more diverse?
Not really. This cast of heroes would have been very comfortable anytime in, like, I think going back to the 40s, you have a bunch of kind of young to middle-aged professionals. You have a scientist, you have the scientist's beautiful daughter, who's the love interest of one of his assistants. I feel like we've seen this setup quite a bit. And none of these characters are really fleshed out enough to even to really answer that question in any more depth.
Does the genre leave its sort of local Caribbean roots and move on to the broader world stage?
Well, I would be interested to know how Mexicans and the different people groups that live in Mexico tell stories like this that touch on their own historical roots.
Yeah, would be too. I don't know enough about it, but it's real. I thought it was really interesting. I want to watch those Aztec mummy movies.
Yes.
To see what they're like. Yeah.
Yeah. So I can't really tell from my distance from Mexican culture and the language and geographically, I can't tell if this is a crass, dumb, thoughtless, like horror plot thrown together with, because they had some cool Aztec looking outfits at the studio.
Right.
Or if this is something that had actual cultural resonance to the viewers of this film. I just don't really know. I think
I
it was probably
either
a hokey schlock fest for the most part.
Right.
And I think that partly because, you know, at the beginning when we're shown those ruins, they're not even ruins from like within 1,000 years of each other or the same culture as each other.
Right.
That makes me think we're dealing with, like, you know, a pretty a Hollywood type approach to this.
Right. All right. Do you want to ask me anything?
I do. I have a couple of our final wrap up questions, John. Would you and I survive this zombie world?
Only because I wouldn't plunder an Aztec tomb.
Yes. If I had,
the zombie part, the Aztec mummy zombie would probably get me.
This one's pretty intimidating.
Yes.
Most of these movies rely on the main character fainting or something, because, or tripping, because that's the only way the monster could catch you. I think that Chiyu could probably get you.
Your Terminator analogy is pretty good for Chiyu here.
Yeah. John, is this a zombie movie or is this a movie with zombies?
I'm not even sure it's a movie with zombies, but if I have to categorize it, I'll say it's the latter.
It's definitely a mummy movie.
Right.
I think it is very weakly a movie with zombies, and I would argue that the zombies are maybe more importantly Marta and Roberto than the mummy, than the than Chiyu.
I think you're right, is that there is, because they're the two who behave in the most in the way we consider zombies, because when they're under the influence of the Ring of Death or Chiyu, they don't speak, they have blank stares, they feel more like zombies, all the way back to the woman in White Zombie who almost kills her husband.
I mean, a really similar scene. She's hovering above her husband with a knife, you know. So that's, lastly, John, would you recommend this movie? Firstly, just generally as a movie that everyone should put on their viewing list. And secondly, do you recommend it specifically to someone that wants to really dig into a piece of zombie lore?
Yeah, part of me wants to say, like, this is just a fun, schlocky, over-the-top movie. It has two strikes against it. One, which is not its fault, which is there's no good subtitled or dubbed version of it for American or non-Spanish speaking viewers. So that's a strike. It's not its fault, but it's a strike against a recommendation. Secondly, I think it's too slow. Like, all the pieces are there, but it's ultimately a little bit of a snoozer. And then to the second part, I don't think there's quite enough. There's a couple of interesting ideas in here, which are zombie-esque. You know, I'll say yes. I think there's some fun stuff in here because I think it challenges our idea of a zombie. Maybe it's just a throwback, but I think it's enough for a zombie lover to maybe check it out. But I'll say no to general.
Yeah, I think I'll agree with you. I agree. I bet you there's a better Aztec Mummy movie than this. So
yes, probably.
I feel confident that there is. So this is, I mean, it is kind of fun. It's a fun setup, but I'm sure there's a better one. So go find a better one to watch.
Right.
Yeah, I'm going to give it a no, but it's maybe a weak no on recommending it to zombie fans. I just don't see much here that feels like it's going to stick around. And the artifact thing is, I guess, kind of interesting, but I guess we'll see. I don't think artifacts are really going to be part of the zombie mythology, but I might be wrong. So
yeah, we'll see.
Yeah. Well, we are finally to the scariest part of the episode, and that is where producer Brad shows me and John what lies in store for us next.
Well, our next movie is American. It was featured on Mystery Science Theater 3000. So from September 1963, here is the poster.
Bodies for sale. Monstrosity.
Okay. Bodies for sale. That's
Right. And there's the cat again.
Yes. Okay. There's all right.
The cat has a credit on the poster.
Yeah. So featured on this poster is a really bad drawing of a black cat. And then three scantily clad women sort of wrapped in chains. And it says, "Wanted. Youth and beauty will pay millions. Only beautiful and shapely girls need apply. No references required. Appointments after dark only."
Do you think you need, is the reference to confirm that you are beautiful and shapely?
Yeah, I guess.
But they'll take your word for it, I guess.
And the cat's name is Xerxes? How would you say the cat's name? X-E-R-E-S.
Yes, Ceres or something.
Yeah. Weird. All right. I'm going to go out on a limb and say this isn't going to be the highest class movie that we've seen. Welcome 1960s properly as we watch Monstrosity.
I do recognize one name in the credits, but I won't say anything until next week.
Oh, all right.
All right. I'm intrigued.
Well, now I'm looking. I recognize it too. Well, maybe not. You know what? I'm going to not speculate or guess, Bradley. I would like to hear what producer Brad has to say next week.
Can I just say, it is charming that the cat gets a credit. Like, that's charming.
Yes.
Like, the rest of this poster is really off-putting, I would say, but that's charming. So, okay.
the cat better have a big role now if it has a credit on the poster.
Yes, it's not well drawn. We don't know its role, but at least it's got a credit. This is an Emerson Film Enterprises, Inc. release, so I hopefully producer Brad will have some juicy bits about what that is, because I assume it's not a studio, a venerated studio that went on to produce, you know, some 70s epic that we're all familiar with. So, all right, I'm ready. But before we get to Monstrosity, Andy and I are going to release our long anticipated, or at least long talked about, episode about
gestating.
Our gestating episode about what makes the 1960s scary. So you can look forward to that next episode, and then Monstrosity, the episode after that. Thanks for listening, everybody. You've been listening to Zombie Strains. We'll be back next episode to talk about another zombie movie. If you enjoyed our podcast, please take a moment to rate us in your podcast app of choice. Tell a friend, follow us on Instagram at Zombie Strains. All of this helps like-minded people find the show. See you next time.